Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Arya Irani, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally, in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door or to visit our website at www.hinckley.utah.edu to get more information. The title of today's forum is Careers in the State Department. Today's guest is Maxwell H. Stoneman. Maxwell H. Stoneman arrived at the U.S. Consulate General in Casablanca as a first tour consular officer in April 2011. Max has worked as the unit chief for the consulate's immigrant visa section, non-immigrant visa section, and now as the American Citizen Services section public affairs before his next assignment as the assistant public affairs officer at the U.S. Embassy in Muscat, Oman. Prior to the Foreign Service, he did graduate work at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem, focusing on Israeli studies. His foreign languages include French, Arabic, Hebrew, and Portuguese. A native of Salt Lake City, Max graduated from Brigham Young University with a bachelor's degree in Middle East Studies and Arabic. As part of his undergrad program, he studied Arabic at the University of Jordan in Amman for 4 months. Prior to joining the Department of State, he worked at Classical 89 KBYU FM as an on-air announcer and producer. Max's wife, Brooke Stoneman, is a librarian, blogger, and book artist. They like to cook, perform music, and walk their dog, Buckley, together. Please join me in introducing Maxwell Stoneman.
All right, so is the microphone working already? I tend to project because I grew up doing community theater with my family, and so if you needed to be heard, you had to really speak up. So is it not on? Test.
Oh, yeah.
There we go. Okay, brilliant. All right, and the other thing is I'm not terribly familiar with this, so I hope you'll bear with me. But thank you, Arya, for that kind introduction. It's really good to be back here at the U. I was actually here for a semester after I was in Brazil for 2 years, and then I was dragged south by my wife, who's in the back, and I hope no one will hold that against me. And I hope KUER also didn't have a problem that I worked for KBYU. It's just ironic that that kind of came together. In any case, I wanted to get everyone's idea about diplomats and diplomacy. When you think of a diplomat, what do you expect to see? What's your expectation?
Compromise.
Compromise? What else? What do you visualize?
Problem solvers.
Problem solvers? Do you see someone by themselves in a corner? Groups of people? Okay. Dignified is kind of a, let's see, there we go. So in terms of dignity, I mean, the stereotype about a State Department employee or a diplomat is the pinstriped cookie monkey who basically walks up to people at a reception holding a bunch of cookies. And that was kind of the stereotype for years and years. But this is me with my friend and colleague Angela Wise in Casablanca about 2 weeks ago. We were at a book fair. And we were requested, the request came through that we would perform in American costumes. We didn't really know what that meant. So we just kind of improvised and we sang, "She'll Be Coming Around the Mountain," and she plays the banjo, I play the guitar. But then we gave the whole presentation in French because none of the little kids would understand if we didn't. So this for me is kind of this sums it up in terms of diplomacy. In the 21st century, it's that what you expect is not really going to happen. It's the unexpected that will happen. And so I never expected I would be dressed like this and singing in front of a bunch of kids after I joined the Foreign Service and took the oath as an officer in the Foreign Service. But this is what we do to tell America's story and to improve relations with America's allies and friends abroad. I didn't think I'd be Santa Claus either, but I was. twice. I guess it's because I'm the most portly and one of the lowest ranking officers, and so that kind of worked out. But one of the things about the Foreign Service is that it really is a service. You're going out and helping people. So here, I dressed up as Santa. My friend Val, who's our security officer, dressed up as an elf. There's a colleague of mine in the consular section, Becky, and our econ officer, Erica. We put together a Christmas benefit for an orphanage, bringing toys and clothes and things like that, and we bring them to the official residence of our principal officer and give them the presents and give them a nice day. We decorated cookies and made gingerbread houses, and it's really neat because that's not really your job. Like, my job as a consular officer is doing visa adjudication, student visas and visitor visas and H-1Bs and C-1Ds and all the alphabet soup of visas. But these kind of activities are really kind of the heart of the Foreign Service community. You're going out and you're making a difference in people's lives. So that's me, my wife Brooke, my brother Augie, who's here, and photobombing us in the back is Karen, who is a Foreign Service specialist. She was an office management specialist. And this is something else. The reception is actually a big deal. When you have a reception in the Foreign Service, you know, the principal officers and the people who are in charge of the catering and the logistics and planning and invitations and lighting and the program and music and things like that, you work on a giant committee to get it all working and happening at the right time. And so for this this was the July 4th reception, 2012. And that's the biggest reception an embassy or a consulate will put on every year. And so our biggest contacts, all the people we work with from the local government, this is in Casablanca, Morocco, which was my first tour. And we decided to highlight the different foods of these different regions because that was something neat, that was something special that perhaps Moroccan people had never encountered, cornbread or Boston baked beans or mint juleps. These were all things that we thought we would offer to them, and it was a big hit. And that was something neat because, again, we get to tell America's story, we get to advocate for American interests, and we get to serve American citizens abroad. Let's see. So this is just a little bit of information about the Department of State, headed by Secretary of State John Kerry. It was Madam Secretary Hillary Clinton when I joined. The State Department is staffed by Foreign Service officers like myself, and civil service officers. Civil service officers are generally based in the United States, usually in Washington, but also in other places that process passports and things like that. Embassies, consulates, missions, and posts abroad, excuse me, there's about 265. The bureaus in Washington are divided, they're either regional, so NEA is Near Eastern Affairs, so that's Morocco to Oman. That's the Near East. EUR is Europe. Western Hemisphere Affairs is North and South America. There are also bureaus that are functional, so all they care about are human rights. And so bureaus that are in charge of, for example, the J Bureau is in charge of the report on trafficking in persons. Congress requests a report on how all the different countries are doing. Thank you. All the different countries are doing in terms of trafficking in persons. And so that report has to be compiled in every single country and then delivered to Congress. Public diplomacy, obviously, that's something I'm very keen on. So my first tour was at the U.S. Consulate General in Casablanca, Morocco. I was there for 2 years, and just came in yesterday, actually. So that's why I'm still jet-lagged and my throat sounds terrible. But I started off doing immigrant visa adjudications, including the diversity visa lottery, the green card lottery, if you've heard of that. I did that for about a year. And then I was in charge of non-immigrant visa adjudications, and the consulate in Casablanca does all of the visa adjudications for the country of Morocco. So we did something like 25,000 last year. And we're one of the very smallest consulates. So a place like Beijing or a place like Brasilia or Sao Paulo would do many, many, many thousands more visas than we did. And then finally, I ended up in American Citizen Services, and I was basically in charge of making sure that Americans abroad were kept informed of different updates, security concerns. If there was some kind of issue with, there were spontaneous protests in Morocco. We were actually sent home early one day to avoid protests that were going to be in front of our consulate. And we had to get that information out to American citizens in case they were coming to the consulate for services. So beyond that, if Americans are destitute and they can't get home, they need to have a repatriation loan, we provide that service as well. Emergency passports, American children born abroad, you have to register them to make sure they have their citizenship. These are all things that are done in the American Citizen Services section. My next tour starts in August, and I'll be at the U.S. Embassy in Muscat, Oman. And my two-year tour will be as the Assistant Public Affairs Officer. My friend earlier that had the banjo, that's her job right now in Casablanca. So I'll be doing that job in the embassy in Muscat. And public affairs officers manage exchange programs, VIP visits. For example, Secretary Clinton was scheduled to come to Morocco back in December. And she was going to participate in the Friends of Syria conference there, discussing the uprising in Syria. Now, she didn't make it because she was sick, but Undersecretary Burns, William Burns, he came in her stead. But all kinds of people were mobilized in order to make sure that that visit went off well and that bilateral discussions were going on that were productive, along with overseeing English language instruction and advising the ambassador on press and outreach. And so that'll be my job. And lucky for me, I get about 3 months of training in D.C. because I really don't know how to do any of these things. I know how to do visas. So it's going to be interesting to figure out how to go about doing that. So if you want to join the Foreign Service, there's an app for that. DOS Careers, it's actually really neat. The Foreign Service process to get into the Foreign Service is actually really, really long, drawn out, difficult, ridiculous. Any adjective you want to, you can apply to it. The Foreign Service Officer Test is the written exam. And there are all kinds of questions on there about U.S. history, politics, the Constitution, management, general knowledge type things, practically trivia. At some point. And this app has 500 of these sample questions. And so it'll be a great preparation for you if you're considering this kind of career. It's a great prep to go through and actually test yourself on it. It also provides information about retired Foreign Service officers who are willing to share their experience with you, give you advice. There's also the Diplomat in Residence Program. Philip Egger, who is based out of Arizona State University, I believe, he is the Diplomat in Residence for this region. And so his entire job is to answer your questions about joining the Foreign Service if you're interested. And that information for contacting him is also on this app, on this application. This is Buckley. He's our favorite souvenir. We got him in Casablanca. And if you're going abroad, do yourself a favor. Do the American Citizen Services officer in the embassy or consulate where you're going a favor and sign up for the STEP program. There is a lot of instability and uncertainty in the world today. And if you're traveling in a region that is experiencing some kind of upheaval or some kind of unrest, you'll want to be informed of updates that are going on in that area. And that is essentially the most fundamental service that embassies and consulates provide, is helping American citizens abroad. So if you are planning a study abroad, if you're planning a spring break trip, some kind of summer jaunt in Europe or something like that, sign up for STEP, and you can say, this is where I'm going to be and when I'm going to be there. And so you'll be provided with updates from the embassies and consulates while you're doing that. Is that it? That's it for that one. Now, I wanted to be sure to leave enough time, so I'll just... Oh, we're already there. So I'm going to kind of click through this, but I'm sure you have questions, and I'd love to answer them. So just fire away if you're ready, but there's a little bit of information here that I did not cover. And you can all read faster than I can talk. So, and that's Main State there in Washington, D.C. How many of you knew about the Foreign Service before today? All right, good on you. There was a group of students traveling through Morocco. It was like the first week of April, last week of March, and I asked them how many of them had heard of the Foreign Service, and about two people timidly raised their hands, and I was like, okay, well, I am it. So my first posting in Morocco and then my second there in Muscat will be right there, right next to to Iran, Yemen, Saudi Arabia, Pakistan. It's a really interesting neighborhood that we're going to be posted for the next 2 years. We're going to be watching the news. So the consulate and the embassy, they're two different places of business for Foreign Service officers. The embassy is where the ambassador or the chief of mission is located. And so for Morocco, that's Rabat, which is the capital of Morocco. And Ambassador Samuel Kaplan, who's actually ending his term here in the next few weeks, he was the ambassador to Morocco. And then his deputy chief of mission is a career Foreign Service officer who advises the ambassador on relations with that country. And then they're divided. Management, consular, public diplomacy, econ, political, regional, security, other agencies like the Department of Agriculture, the Department of Treasury, the Department of Commerce, USAID, and the Peace Corps. And so for consular, I've already talked to you about that, visas, American Citizen Services. Management makes it all happen. They keep the lights on. They keep the bills being paid. And then public diplomacy, as you could see with the banjo and the guitar, it's getting the story out there. And then econ political, you're reporting on that country. So with political affairs, you're looking at how the country is, how it's being run, where there are problems or where there are concerns. Then you report on those things back to Congress, back to Washington, to the president. And then the same with econ, with economic affairs. One of the really interesting things we got to do was monitor the first direct elections that Morocco had ever had. They had a new constitution put in place in the summer of 2011, and then later on that year, they elected their prime minister for the first time in their history. The prime minister had always been selected by the king up until that time. So Brooke and I got to be in a car for about 14 hours one day, just driving to all these different polling places and monitoring how the election was going to make sure it was free and fair. And that was a fascinating and really uplifting experience for me because it was free, it was fair. There was this real political dialogue going on there. People were ready to vote in that way. And so it was really exciting for me to participate in that. Regional security, they keep us safe. And then, like I say, other departments have Foreign Service officers as well. The agricultural Foreign Service officer who advises the ambassador on agricultural issues is probably one of the most important people in the embassy to the host country. Their reports are, you know, with wheat and with corn and all these different forecasts and things. It's a big deal, the work that agriculture does in the embassies.
I have a question.
Please. Yeah, absolutely. So we have at the consulate in Casablanca, we have a foreign commercial service officer. Her name's Jane Kitson. She's amazing. And she had a four-year term there at the consulate. My term was only 2 years, but that's because I'm in the Foreign Service. I'm a junior officer, and that was my consular rotation. And then as, you know, you progress in rank, in the middle level, in the senior Foreign Service, the term of a tour can be 3 years or 4 years or even extended to five. For European countries, it's actually a lot longer. There was a guy from Norway I met in Rabat who'd been there for almost a decade. I mean, they're there for a long, long time. That country is basically their career. Any other questions about the... Yes?
Maybe you mentioned this earlier. I can't remember.
No problem. Between econ, poli-sci, management, psych, I'd say yes. I mean, what they're looking for, literally, you're called a generalist. If you enter the Foreign Service and you're looking for one of these, it's called a cone, basically. Thank you so much. You determine your cone, what your career track is going to be from the very get-go. And so for me, I decided public diplomacy was the way to go for me because I like doing public diplomacy. I like being up in front of people and talking. Other people don't. Other people prefer, you know, there's kind of a routine. There's a statistics-driven way of doing business in the consular cone, other people with management. So if you're leaning toward one or the other, you should have a little bit of subject matter expertise. But still, you have to be a generalist. You have to be interchangeable with different, bless you, with different sections and with different portfolios. Yeah, go ahead.
Is there a cone where there's more demand and perhaps
There are. Management and consular. Management and consular. And the fact is, even if you are a straight management officer and all your tours are only ever management tours, you're still doing a lot of public diplomacy. You're still doing a lot of reporting on the economic issues that you're dealing with, like paying bills and getting contractors to come in, seeing how the businesses are working in your country. So even if you just choose management or consular, you're still able to do other jobs as well. You have the opportunity to work around in the different sections. Yeah?
Aside from your educational experience, what type of professional experience are they looking for?
You know, you have to have a high school diploma and be an American citizen. I mean, that's it. And that's it. And so in my incoming class, there was one guy who'd never been abroad. He'd never been outside the United States and didn't speak another language. And he was in. There was another person who I think he'd gone to college for a few years. He didn't have a bachelor's degree. But the thing is, it's like the testing process, the selection process, it is looking for a diversity of experience. And if you are able to, first of all, test well, and then second of all, quantify and describe that experience very well, you're in. That's really it. That's what they're looking for. So it's the big joke in the State Department is that every question ends with the answer, well, it depends. And that's really it. It's like, well, does this certain major make it easier to get in? Well, it depends. I don't know. It really does depend on each individual candidate and what they're prepared, how they've prepared themselves going into the process.
So I want to let you keep continuing your slideshow, but obviously we're starting to get into some questions, and I'd love to get this on the radio. So if you do have questions, I'll find you, and before you say it, just make sure I get the microphone to you so you can say it into the microphone.
Okay. So this is just something interesting. Foreign service kids. I mean, there are a lot of really great schools. So as single young people go into the Foreign Service and they get married and they have children, this is a big consideration. So these are American schools. These are generally like private school level of academic excellence, you could say. And so these American schools have a relationship with the State Department and the U.S. government. What else have we here? Okay, so internships is actually something, this is something really neat to do. The photo I showed you about the July 4th reception that we did at the official residence, that really couldn't have happened without the summer interns that were there to help. We had, I think, half a dozen of them. And literally, it's like moving tables, setting tablecloths, getting settings out there, making sure the lights work, making sure the sound system works, making sure that there's ice in the various ice buckets. Like, they were all over the place, and it was a big help. But then, I mean, their summer job was doing economic reporting. Their summer job was making sure that the Diplomatic Security Service had all the staff they needed during a busy summer season. So it's a really great, practical, professional experience to do an internship with the Department of State. And they are abroad. They're also in Washington. Yes, sir?
Like when you see some of these internships advertised on USA Jobs.
Yes, sir.
Okay, they say you have to be a student in the local area, so students or people who live in D.C., San Francisco, New York, Houston, kind of have an advantage over people who live in Missoula, Montana, or Salt Lake, or, I don't know, Tucson, Arizona.
That's true.
So isn't that kind of unfair?
Well, you know, if you're looking for an internship in Washington, that can be difficult. What I do know is that there are a variety of opportunities for people to try out for those internships. I personally never gone through that process, but I'm confident that if there's not something there in Washington, there are other internships abroad that a variety of students, regardless of their geographic location, would be able to apply for.
And I would like to say that through Hinckley, we have a lot of relationships in Washington, D.C. I have to put my plug in for Hinckley,
Absolutely.
Obviously.
Go ahead.
But no, just being a part of this department allows you to really reach out and do some stuff that otherwise by yourself you really couldn't. So again, if you're interested in this, please use the resources around you.
So, Okay, the civil service, like I said, they're usually based in Washington, but there are, if you apply for a passport, generally it's a civil service officer who's adjudicating your passport application, making sure it gets to you, making sure all the information is correct. Then a generalist, like I say before, 5 broad career tracks of consular, econ, management, political, and public diplomacy. Then you have specialists, and so if you are a doctor, or if you are an information technology expert, if you have human resources expertise, there are a variety of specialist jobs that are available in the State Department. And that's something interesting for people who, you know, perhaps the generalist track isn't for you, but the specialist track would provide you with the Foreign Service life, which I think is appealing to a lot of people who want to live abroad, who want to study new cultures and new languages and places. So, service to your country. I'm sure those of you are aware, about a week ago, a Foreign Service officer was killed in Afghanistan. And I didn't know Ann Smetanov, but a friend of mine from my incoming class of diplomats actually worked with her. She's in Kabul right now. And it was a really crushing loss for everyone there and everyone who knew her, because she was so bright and she was so dedicated to what she was doing. I'm really proud to know that I'm doing the same work that she's doing. I'm really proud to know that she was doing something she believed in. She was bringing textbooks to kids. Like if we were at a book fair and I was in a ridiculous outfit and I was singing songs to little children, but we were providing books, we were providing knowledge, and we were doing something that was good, that was positive, that was building peace, that was building positive relationships with people. And so that makes me proud to serve my country. That makes me very proud to be doing what I'm doing. And there's a lot of pride to serve in the Foreign Service. So just apart from that, that's a big deal for me. Help and Protect Americans, there was an applicant who came in for an immigrant visa at some point. He'd already lived in the United States. And he'd been married to a woman, and they'd had a child. And one of the things we ask is, are you paying your child support? And he kind of looked at me. And I said, okay, can I take that as a no? He said, yeah, it's a no. And I spent about a week searching for this woman that he hadn't been paying child support to. And I finally found her. And I said, would you like him to start paying child support? And she said, yeah. And so I was able to do that. And that was, I felt really good about that. I like my job when I'm able to help people like that. Because we're supposed to help and serve Americans. We're supposed to protect and advocate American interests in the Foreign Service. Interesting life experiences. Yeah, dressing up like a cowboy and singing in French and English, that's pretty wild. Learn foreign languages. I'm paid to know Arabic. I was getting paid to learn French. I mean, you are supposed to be worldwide available, worldwide applicable. And so it's a neat career if that's what you're into. Foreign cultures and experiences. That's pretty much all I had today. So, I mean, I'm here for another half hour if you'd like, just answering questions. You know, feel free.
So now we will open the time for questions. Again, please remember to just say a little bit about yourself and speak clearly in the microphone.
Hi, my name's Amber Anderton. I'm sorry I showed up a little late.
It's all good.
I was wondering, are there any hard, is there a hard rule of anything that would disqualify you from serving the state? State.
Hard rule. I think that felony conviction, I think that that's something that could disqualify you. I'm pretty sure that a high school diploma is actually required. So if you don't have that, then you could possibly get a GED. I don't know. All of the information is on the website as you fill out the application, and you do have to be an American citizen. But beyond that, basically, as the pack is cold during the selection process, some people reach kind of a brick wall. And I'm not sure if that's a hard, fast no, if that's the answer you're looking for, but some people do kind of hit that wall because it is very, very competitive. Go ahead.
Clayson Quigley. My question is actually for your wife. She's in the back. I'm curious to know about your experience as the spouse of somebody.
Do you want to come up?
If you could let us know just kind of like what you do on a day-to-day basis. He's kind of described to us, but is there stuff for you to do? And it sounds like you've been able to go with him. It was really interesting to hear him talk about the elections and that you were able to be a part of that. What are your experiences?
Sure. First of all, I love it. I've had a very positive experience. There are things that are difficult about it. Change is frequent and constant. So if you can deal with those kinds of things, and everything is unfamiliar. And for me, that's exciting, and that's something that I like. I look forward to. But for a lot of people, that kind of instability is not fun. But I have had lots of opportunities I wouldn't have had had we stayed here. So my first – actually, there's lots of chances for work in the consulate or the embassy for spouses. So my first job when we got there, I was the public affairs officer, the assistant public affairs officer. So it's a joke that I'll help him figure it out, and he'll know what to do. And then I got to work in the regional security office. So I've had a lot of – my training is in – I'm a librarian by training. So they're kind of related, but I've got to do these different things. So they're very conscientious of employment opportunities for spouses. There's also this great network, this community. There's an entire job. It's called the community liaison officer, who's interested in helping spouses liaise with the community. So if that's work, if that's cultural events, if that's just a coffee group, whatever it is, there's a lot of institutional support for spouses. So within the community, there are these opportunities. But by and large, it's just been a fantastic experience to be able to meet new people and to learn things. But it is a commitment. And I think it's better when people make it with their eyes open, because some people, one person is more committed than the other, and they don't really understand all the things that will go into it. And that becomes difficult for your family or for your marriage or for your employment. So I think it's good to go into it eyes wide open. Does that answer your question?
Also wanted to mention the Department of State, especially under Secretary Hillary Clinton, the Department of State really expanded benefits for same-sex partners. So for the LGBT community, the State Department is actually a great place to work. And so that's been a big improvement. There was a survey done just barely about federal agencies. The State Department ranked number 3 out of, I think, 18 or 19 federal agencies of places to work. That's across the spectrum.
Hi, my name is Alini, and I have a couple of questions. Since there's no degree requirement, how hard are these tests so that, you know, the selection becomes pretty final, or that you keep, you know, quality people to represent the country? And also, as far as nationality, if you become an American through naturalization process, that's still
absolutely
also okay?
Absolutely, yeah. Okay. In my incoming class, I think there were 15 generalists who were either born in another country or had another nationality from their parents. But they had dual nationality, and that's just fine. That's really just fine. Excuse me. The test is really hard. The test is really, really hard. Like, I skin of my teeth passed the written test. It really puts you in, it pushes you as far as you can go and then some. It's trying to determine where you stop functioning as a normal brain, basically. Like, if it can push you to the point where you're no longer able to express yourself, then, yeah, that's when they find that point, whether that's crossed the threshold or not is up to how difficult they're making it to get into the Foreign Service at that time. About 100,000 people take the written exam every year, and only about 8,000 are invited to the oral assessments, which is the day-long in-person like relay race of different real-time scenarios. So the oral assessment is where you sit down. Your first scenario is where you sit down with 7 other strangers, and you're each given a project to advocate for. And then you're given a budget where exactly 1.5 or 2 of these projects are actually going to be funded. And by consensus, you have to determine which ones they're going to be. And then you have to write a memo. You have to do it in 30 minutes. And it's rough. And then the next one is where you sit down, they give you a giant binder of something, and you have to write a memo of all the information that's in the binder. That one's timed as well. And then you have an interview where you're sitting by yourself, but you're interviewed by two people at practically the same time. And so they're testing your composure, they're testing your adaptability, your flexibility, and things like that. And so out of those 8,000, you know, a few hundred are invited to actually join an incoming class of diplomats to join the Foreign Service. And so it's, you know, a fraction of a percent of those who initially start out, apply, and take the written exam end up entering the Foreign Service in any given cycle. So it's exceptionally difficult. But possible.
Questions? We're still open.
Hi, my name is Mackenzie. I would just ask, and I know it's not your area of expertise, but a little bit more about the specialist track, if you can speak to if those are people who maybe have a few years of professional work experience before they transition to the public sector versus the private sector, or how individuals go about that track.
Sure, absolutely. So the primary specialists that I interact with, you have office management specialists, who do basically secretarial work, protocol interactions, liaison with other parts of the embassy. So, for example, the ambassador has an office management specialist, and she is the gatekeeper. And she, you know, confirms that the ambassador is on schedule, that things are going on track, that the different meetings are there, that if there's going to be a change, she knows who to contact. There's also the OMS for the principal officer at our consulate, and he knows, you know, when the meetings are happening and who's driving and what the logistics are. And to get into that track, you have to demonstrate, obviously, you have to be proficient in all of those different requirements, all those different responsibilities. I don't know how that process works. There is its own exam. You have to have different specializations in it. And there are actually people who become a specialist and then transfer to the Foreign Service generalist track and vice versa. So it's something that's it's a little bit malleable, but you actually have to go through a lot of paperwork to do it. The other specialists we interact with a lot are IT specialists, and there obviously you probably have to have an advanced degree in information technology, networking, programming probably, and so basically after the OMS position, the office management specialist, there is a specific expertise that you're supposed to have. And I'm not sure about real-world experience or job experience, but I imagine that would be very helpful.
Hi, my name is Satine, and I'm a political science major and also pre-med. My question for you is, well, I'm really curious about the relation between Iran right now. I understand that Iran has no embassy, but I'm just curious, there are some bodies of government that have to have people who work for them that help them out with any relations with Iran. And I don't think that is there anything in the Department of State in regards to Iran?
I mean, what we have in the Department of State, obviously we have a lot of people who keep an eye on what's going on in Iran. People who read the news, who watch the broadcasts, who are, you know, interested in what's being said in the various broadcast sermons and things like that. All kind of, you know, public information and things. And obviously, you know, the Secretary of State has mentioned the possibility of talks with certain conditions. Again, that's not my area of expertise. I'm not really sure what's going on there. I can't really speak to it. But obviously, we're looking for a more stable region. We're looking for a more stable world. And so relations with Iran would promote that. And so my understanding would be that if there are talks in the future, there would have to be certain conditions met first. But that's still the goal, that there would be normalized relations in the future. I hope that answered your question.
My name's Isaac. Just curious, not to pry into your business or anything, but how much do you make? Well, not you, but how much on average does someone make in this line of work? I'm sure it depends on the kind of work they do, but like on average, what salary?
You can Google it. Actually, I'm a public servant, so my salary's online. You can Google it. Foreign Service Pay Schedule, And we had a pay freeze for about 3 years, and I think they've just barely updated it now, and it's all there. It just depends on your rank. Not the GS scale, it's actually the FS scale, the Foreign Service scale.
Okay, so my questions are really specific, so I'm not sure if you answer them. I actually applied for the internship program for this fall.
Oh, okay.
Do you know when, because it seems like it takes a while to hear back.
It does.
Do you know about the timelines it takes to hear back? And
no idea. I'm sorry. Okay. I'm sorry.
It's all right, I'll guess it's, I'll just wait.
That's public diplomacy, so that's one of the things that they administer, are exchange and cultural programs. And that's the internships and things, that's one of the things they do, but I've never worked there. So I just don't know. I'm sorry. But good luck. And if you get a chance, I mean, it's a great experience.
Hi again. Mm-hmm. I have 6 years of federal service under my belt already.
Okay.
I did an enlistment in the military and worked for a couple federal agencies. Would that time transfer over?
It would. Well, basically, everyone going into the Foreign Service begins as a junior officer. But there is a range of rank of where you start out. There's FS6, which is the lowest of the low. That's where I started. And then there's 5, and then there's 4. And so if you already have several years of federal service under your belt, that means that you would be ranked that much higher going in from the get-go. But then you're on basically probation for 3 years, 3 to 5 years, and they determine whether or not they're going to give you tenure and make you a career officer as opposed to a career candidate. And so I'm up for tenure this summer, and keeping my fingers crossed, but I mean, I have up to 5 years in order to get it, in order to become a career officer in the Foreign Service.
I also have a disability rating. Do you think that would impede my chances?
The question is, and that was one of the slides earlier, is about worldwide availability. Now, one of the things you have to go through is a suitability review panel after you've passed all the tests, after you've, you know, flying colors, whatever. Medically, and then security, you have to be able to be posted anywhere in the world. And so they have to determine if you're healthy enough to be in a place like Beijing where the air quality is not excellent. You know, if you're okay to be in a place where the medical services perhaps aren't great. You know, I've got friends in Angola, and the medical services that are available there are not what you would hope for. And so that's one of the really big considerations is worldwide availability in the Foreign Service. And so I can't speak specifically to yours, but obviously that's a big consideration going into a Foreign Service career.
Yeah. My name's Preston, and just to kind of add to that, I was wondering, you obviously work with people in the Peace Corps who are at the embassy, and then
yeah.
I'm sure a lot of your class, entering class, was Peace Corps people, so mm-hmm. I was wondering how that impacts your chances of getting in.
RPCVs, man.
Yeah.
Return Peace Corps volunteers.
Yeah, so I just was wondering how that impacts your ability, or do they place you in the place where you served your Peace Corps?
You know, sometimes they do, but mostly they don't. Like, I was, you have to bid on your first tour, and I bid Casablanca, that was my number one. I already spoke Arabic, you know, it looked like a great place to serve. And there was a returned Peace Corps volunteer who had done his Peace Corps service in Morocco for 3 years, spoke Moroccan Arabic perfectly, and I was like, nah, that's not going to happen. Not going to happen. But he got sent to the Gulf, and I got sent to Casablanca. So it was completely unexpected. But again, the Peace Corps experience is phenomenal. It's a great preparation for a Foreign Service life. And, I mean, RCPVs, you guys, they're hardcore. You know, they want to go to the tough places. They want to go to the hardship places. They want to have, you know, a really great experience in a place where it's really happening. You know, they don't do well in Paris. They don't do well in Frankfurt. So it's a really neat experience.
And then I also have another question, and that's, mm-hmm. So your next tour is going to be in Oman.
Yeah.
When did you find out that it was going to be in Oman? And obviously, you said 3 more months of training before you go there.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering what the time frames look like.
Sure. So generally, you bid about a year after you arrive to a post on your next post. So I actually bid on an Arabic program that would get me a little bit more experience learning and studying Arabic so I could get a bit more fluency. That kind of fell apart after there were, I was getting trained during the Arab Awakening, basically. And so all of these different places that have been, you know, kind of a bastion of Arabic study and things, they were no longer viable. So that kind of threw a wrench in the works. And so I knew that I was going to Oman about 2 years ago. but I didn't know it was going to be under these conditions. So it's now been expanded to a 2-year post as the assistant public affairs officer, and then I'll be bidding on my third tour probably within a year. Got it.
Question.
In my incoming class, there were, I'd say, 10 who were over the age of 50. Now, I had 96 in my class coming in. I mean, it was a huge class of people. But a lot of them were on their fourth or fifth career at that point. Some of them had already been working for the State Department as office management specialists or contracting agents. But there were a number of them who were, this was their alley-oop to retirement. No, you are required to retire from the Foreign Service. And I forget if the age is, it might be 62, but it might be 65. But you have to be able to do, I think, at least 5 years of service before you retire. And so there is a cap. And again, all the information is at careers.state.gov, where you fill out the application to sign up for it. 60.
You have to be picked up for 1 year before your 60th birthday.
Okay, so that's it. No, but there were a number of them in my incoming class. All of them had kids in college.
Questions? We still have about 10 minutes.
I'd like to ask a question.
Oh, go ahead.
You have a question? I saw it pop up at the last second.
When do you think is the best time to get involved and kind of pursue the career in the Department of State or in the Foreign Service?
Now.
Okay.
Well, the thing is, it's like the process is really drawn out. In order to go through the entire thing, you go to the website, you fill out the application, and then you apply for a test. And the test could be several months in the future. And after the test, you learn about the results several months after that. And then if you're invited to write essays, you do that, and then you see the results later. I mean, it can take up to 18 to 24 months. So, and the thing about the Foreign Service exam, if you fail it, they give you a year, and then you can take it again. So it's not a bad thing to try it now, to just, you know, get a feel for it, to, you know, get the study guide, give yourself some time to really look into what they're trying to get out of the test from you, and then just take it. I mean, I have friends who took it 4, 5, or 6 times, and they just kept trying and kept trying and kept trying. Sorry, you had a question.
Yeah, hi, my name is Adrian Spiegel, Peace and Conflict Studies and Psychology major here at the U. Just wondering, since you're being stationed in Oman in about a year or the next time, what challenges or obstacles do you believe you're going to be facing in the diplomatic areas in that region?
Dehydration from the heat. But I don't know. Oman is a fascinating place. Like, it's a really interesting country. It is one of the more progressive in the region. It's just right next door to the United Arab Emirates. I can imagine that, you know, being so isolated, it has a very different culture, and so it probably perceives other countries around it in a different way. But challenges, obviously, I think stability. I mean, that region is seeing in Yemen, obviously, in Iran, they're in Pakistan, Afghanistan is just a little bit further afield. I mean, there's a lot of upheaval going on in that area, and so I imagine a lot of that has to do with coordination. A lot of the challenges would be coordination with the Omani government in advocating for our interests in that region. That would be my assumption.
Yeah. Thank you.
You got it. And I'm happy to stay after, you know, if you have, you know, more detailed questions, want to get in the tall weeds of details afterwards. So if you have to go, that's fine. I'm willing to take you know, emails or anything like that if you have questions later on. So
I'm jumping back to your experience getting hired on. Mm-hmm. About how long was it from the time that you took the test until you knew that you had been accepted into the class?
So I applied for the test in January, took it in February, got the results in April, submitted my essays in the same month, got my results at the end of May, signed up for an oral assessment immediately in July, because we were just about to move out to Israel for a year at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And then after I passed the oral assessment, it took about 4 or 5 months for the suitability review panel to medically clear me and then get me my security clearance. And so I knew by November. It was pretty quick for me. So January to November is when I knew. But I didn't actually enter until the following July because I wanted to finish my year in Jerusalem.
Well, we're going to wrap it up now. So please, everyone, join me in thanking Maxwell Stoneman for such an amazing form.